Toys go in and out of fashion, but the gift of a good book can last forever. That's why the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club wants to hear from you about books you loved when you were younger and that you want to share with the young readers in your life. Plus, let's face it, if you're a parent who reads to your children, you probably want to share something that's not just entertaining for your son or daughter, but gives you pleasure as well. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate, on Facebook, or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And to help us in this discussion, we have invited two people who know a thing or two about children's literature. John Shiska, a former national ambassador for young people's literature, founder of Guys Read, and author of books like Math Curse, and Jacqueline Woodson, a National Book Award for Young People's Literature recipient, Young People's Poet Laureate, and author of books like Brown Girl Dreaming. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of you back to our show.
Nice to be here again.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks, Leonard.
Over the summer, we asked listeners to call in with books that had changed their lives, and many of those submissions were books that they had read when they were children or young adults, especially To Kill a Mockingbird. Are we more likely to really love a book when we're young? A book, will those books have more of a lasting impact? What do you think, Jacqueline?
Well, I think To Kill a Mockingbird is absolutely timeless. And it's funny because I gave it to my daughter when she was about 13, and she really loved it. And I think we do have books that stay with us because so much of the young adult and children's literature really forms who we're becoming, so it resonates that way. And another one I'm thinking of course, is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Well, you grew up in Brooklyn?
I did grow up in Brooklyn.
So maybe that's why it has special resonance for you.
Yeah, definitely.
John, did you grow up in Brooklyn?
No, Flint, Michigan.
Ah.
But I moved.
Please
like
don't drink the water, John.
Yeah, no kidding. But Jackie and I have this great secret. I don't know if we should tell you, but
yeah, please do. It's like, all radio. Nobody's listening.
Oh, okay, perfect. As long as we got that out of the way. That's why we love kids as an audience. They are the most incredible readers. They just give you their whole selves. And I think that's why people really remember those books from childhood. It just, like, just forms them, like Jackie was saying. It makes them into who they become.
Some more than others. For example, Maria from Long Island wrote us about The Phantom Toll Booth, which seems to be a perennial favorite. She says it captures the imagination, grows with the child as a reader, and gently delivers philosophical and life lessons without being preachy. When the two of you are writing, is that something you keep in mind?
Once you start getting didactic, your reader is gone, because kids read for the same reason we do. They read because they want to hear a good story and they want to become a part of that dream of fiction. They don't read to learn. I always say if I was going to try to teach children, I would write textbooks, but I write because I have all these questions, and when the kids come to the literature, they're asking questions too about themselves, and it expands them. And I think that's how I think it's more about the children growing from the experience they've had with the literature.
Yeah, and I think that's what every kids book author finds out pretty quickly. Like, if you're coming just to deliver a message, you get eaten alive by your audience also. I guess that's the other secret of our audience. They don't suffer fools gladly. Even if they're first graders, they'll at least show you by picking their nose and rolling around.
Oh, man. I know. And if they're seventh graders, they just heckle.
Oh, that's worse. I don't go with the older ones, yeah.
We have invited our listeners to join the conversation. The number is 212-433-9692, and a whole bunch of people have started calling in. So Jesse from Brooklyn, we've put you on the air. Hi, Jesse.
Yes, hi. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I am calling because the book I got when I was like probably like 9 or 10 from my dad was called 13 Clocks by James Thurber.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting book about a man who wanted to kill time. So he had all these clocks in his house. And he would have a saying, "I'll flick you from your Google to your Zatch."
That's before Google became a word that we all would use.
Yes, a verb, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting. It was a great book.
Was it written for kids or was it written for adults?
It was a book that my dad kind of got me as like a young kid to say, here, you could read this on your own now, as opposed to having, you know, bedtime reading where he would read like rutabaga stories or something like that. But
that was definitely written for kids in the same way like a Phantom Toll Booth. It was just filled with wordplay and great subversive kind of stuff like that.
Let's take another call from Francine from Pelham Bay, Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you today?
We're well. I can't speak for my guests, but I'm okay.
Okay. The two books that I remember deeply from my childhood were The Hannah, about a Quaker girl in pre-Civil War Philadelphia. The author is DeAngelis, Marguerite DeAngelis. And the second one was what you folks have already mentioned, Tree Grows in Brooklyn, by Betty Smith. And they were important to me because they were about people, my own gender, but living lives in situations totally different from where I was living in a very comfortable upper-middle-class environment in New Jersey. And they've stayed with me ever since. I mean, I've bought copies and keep them around the house in my personal library.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling us.
And I think that's an interesting point about the books being very different from one's own life, right? And how, and that's one thing that kids also and adults come to is empathy from seeing those experiences outside their own.
They have to connect to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But no, but they don't want to just read books about their own lives. They already know that.
Exactly.
And we do want to encourage their imaginations. My guests are Jacqueline Woodson and John Shishka, and we are talking about the books that we read as kids that we would love other kids to, our children to read, although in some cases they probably don't like the book as much as we did. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. A listener wrote in to our show page, Rebecca from Keene Valley, New York, rereading Beverly Cleary's Ramona series with my daughter was a gift for both of us. She connected right away to the working-class realistic fiction about Ramona's family and friends, and the books gave her a way to see people in her own world as unique characters and identify narratives within everyday life as potential stories. She's now a sociology major in college, and I think her love of people and their stories goes back to Ramona.
Oh, what a great story. I mean, that's exactly what Jackie and I love to do when we go in to schools and read to kids, too. That you always, you know, there's a kid out there who that's just going to change their life potentially. They might become a writer or, yeah, maybe a great sociologist.
Well, since you both write books for children, I want to ask you about what you choose to write about. John, your books are often humorous takes on elementary school curriculum, math curses about math concepts. Your Time Warp Trio books are about history. Are they informed by your time as a teacher?
Yeah, they definitely came out of, I taught for 10 years in New York City, kind of all ages, from first grade to eighth grade, and it just kind of soaked in to me. Like, it wasn't really my test audience, but I learned from being around those kids, like, just the excitement of looking into those things. And that's the kind of kid I was. I loved history and science, and I just decided when I started writing, like, what a great opportunity to mess around with all these subjects and kind of introduce them to kids in a really fun way.
But when you were first getting your start, didn't publishers tell you that your material was too dark or too sophisticated?
Yeah, those are some of the more polite things they told me. I had other letters.
Did you think they were right, or did you prove them wrong?
Well, I kind of loved it, yeah, because I knew. I'd been around kids for, like, years and just knew they loved that stuff. I mean, I think publishers were horrified that some kid might read The Really Ugly Duckling growing up to be a really ugly duck in The Stinky Cheese Man and be scarred for life. I just said, it happens. I think it's good to know.
Mm-hmm. Jacqueline, I also want to ask you about sticking to your vision, because haven't some of your books contained content that some critics actually wanted censored? You and Judy Blume facing that kind of thing. How do you deal with it?
Oh, man. It's so funny because, you know, Judy Blume was one of the first people to let me know that I was censored because I didn't know. And she was putting together this anthology, The Places That I Never Meant to Be, of writers who'd been censored. And she called me up and wanted to include me. And I'm like, I haven't been censored. She's like, oh, yes, you have. And I think that's the case for a lot of writers. We don't always know when people are choosing not to have our books in their school libraries or in their public libraries or in their home libraries, or when people are speaking out against our work because they're not coming to us with it. But I think it's not going to stop me from telling the stories I'm going to tell.
And you've said that when you started writing, you wanted to talk about things that you felt were underreported in children's literature, but that were very familiar to your life, like communities and protagonists of color, girls and friendship. Did you feel that they were missing in the books that you were reading when you were young?
Well, people of color were definitely missing in the books that I was reading as a young person.
Yeah.
I mean, even when we're listening to people talk, they're not talking about books with people of color for the most part. And it wasn't until I came across books like Louise Merriweather's Daddy Was a Number Runner or Stevie by
Daddy
John
Was a Number Runner.
Yeah, or Stevie by John Steptoe, that those books are Betty Thomas, Down These Mean Streets, books where there were Black and Latino people in them. And so I really wanted to fill that void because I knew we existed and we had stories to tell and they weren't out there.
Well, you were reading, the other alternative was to read stories about white kids. But do you think it's important for white children to read books that are about children of color?
If they don't ever plan to leave their all-white community, I guess they don't need to, but, you know, if they ever plan to meet someone of a different race, I always think, God forbid, let me not be the first person of color someone ever sees or meets. And literature allows you to meet people first in the narrative and then become familiar with that quote-unquote other, the same way for us as kids of color. We met a lot of white folks in our books, and they were very familiar to us when we went out into the world and actually met them.
You grew up in South Carolina and Brooklyn. Were you exposed to different kinds of literature in each place?
Yeah. In South Carolina, I don't remember a lot of the books I read. I mean, my sister was reading books like Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates and a lot of, Hans Christian Andersen, a lot of the Brothers Grimm. And then it was when I came to New York City, I grew up in Bushwick, that I really started finding books, even like Beverly Cleary and Judy Blume and S.E. Hinton, and then eventually James Baldwin, and early on Stevie and Langston Hughes and Nikki Giovanni and those people.
And what about you, John? What were the books that you were reading when you were a kid?
I read a bunch of, I read everything. We had all kinds of books around our house. Like it was Dr. Seuss and Caps for Sale and
yes.
The encyclopedias. I loved reading encyclopedias. I was just that like kind of information nut kid.
And you can't do that anymore.
No.
You got to when you Google,
a,
you only get one answer.
A missing piece. But it's like Jackie said, I don't think I ever saw one person of color in any book that I read. I mean, I think the closest I came would maybe be The Five Chinese Brothers.
Oh, man, remember
which
that.
Which was just crazy. And I'm so proud of our business, the children's book business, for now. We just offer this incredible range of stories about all kinds of people. I mean, I give Brown Girl Dreaming, Jackie's book, to kids everywhere. Boys, too, who you think might not be the classic audience, and just say, hey, check this out. This is nothing like you. Or like Radiant Child by Javaka Steptoe.
Oh, that's
about
so beautiful.
Basquiat. It's just like, man, we get to just show kids the bigger world.
We were talking earlier about men reading Colette. So in the end, good storytelling is good storytelling, isn't it? Human beings are human beings. Judy from Richmond Hill, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, because it's about being different. And when you're a kid and you're different, it can be overwhelming.
And you felt different when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was the only redhead. I had freckles. I had glasses. I read. I was the only one who read any books at all. I was smart. I could listen to a song and know the words to it. every song I ever heard, I knew the words, and I did music. I played violin. You know, I was different.
So the Jonathan Livingston Seagull, She's Not Alone, that was an incredibly popular book. I don't know if some of these books still sell well. Do you know?
I don't know about Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I was reading somewhere online where they were comparing books. You know, if you like this book, you'll love this book. Oh, and yeah. I'm trying to think of what the modern-day Jonathan Livingston Seagull is. I feel like the whole body of children and young adult literature speaks to that. Even, you know, Jonathan Green's book, The Fault in Our Stars, like the books that there are ways of, that these stories are telling that are speaking more to the individuals that are coming to them. But I remember in 10th grade reading Jonathan Livingston Seagull and being moved by it. And then my sister being like, you're so corny. But I was moved by it.
Yeah. And other stuff like the Phantom Tollbooth, that still sells like crazy. Mm-hmm. Or Judy Blume stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's just, definitely.
It's kind of timeless.
Yeah, Mildred Taylor's Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry is another one that's
in fact, listeners have written in about that. Paula from Hudson, New York said that it's a beautifully written book for young adults about a young African-American girl in the South. My mother gave it to me when it came out, and it's always had a place on my bookshelf. But then you got to wonder what happens when you give it to your kid or your grand somebody you want to enjoy it as much as you do. And I hope that some people will call in and talk about that as well as we continue this conversation with Jacqueline Woodson and John Shishka. Our number here, 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with our discussion about children's books, the ones we love, the ones we want to pass on to others, with John Shishka and Jacqueline Woodson, two writers whose books are favorites with so many kids and then parents and then their kids as well. We started talking, Jacqueline, a little bit about audiobooks. In the past, it was pretty much the adult reading to the child, whether it was parent to child or if you went to the library, sometimes librarian read to the kids. But is something lost when a kid hears the audiobook version?
I don't think so. I think it's a different experience, but it's still a literary one. I was starting to say that my daughter and I listened to the audiobook of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn together, and she couldn't understand the Brooklyn accents because the actor is phenomenal. But she has these old, you know, the old school Brooklyn accent, and my daughter's like, what language are they speaking? But some of them, I don't know if you've had this experience, John, some of them are so well done. We just listened to Jason Reynolds' book, Ghost, as an audiobook, and my 8-year-old son, he has it on his iPod, and just had his earbuds in all the time, just walking around the house mesmerized by the story.
Oh, man, I love that book, too. I should go listen to it on audio.
It is phenomenal.
John, you had five brothers. Did you share books?
No, it was kind of a mad free-for-all. My older brother, Jim, and I, we were the two oldest, so we definitely collected Hardy Boys books, and we were very proud that we had a whole shelf full of books, and we kept them in numbered order, which is kind of such a weird, like, boy nerd thing to do, too, I think, which I love sort of tapping into. I have a program called Guys Read, where we just made the set of books, like, collectible, because we knew guys would want to get them all.
Now, Guys Reads, you also include books that have to do with girls?
Oh, absolutely. That's our kind of secret weapon. And, in fact, Jackie is one of the best contributors. She was in the volume All Short Stories. Each one of them is a different genre. And I asked Jackie when I was doing the sports volume if she had any feeling about sports one way or another. And turns out she's a track star. Or sort of was. She wrote this great story. And it's also this great way to introduce kids to, once again, that thing we were talking about, like experiences beyond their life. Like, I hoped kids would come to the book thinking, like, oh, I'm going to read that football story, by that guy or that hockey story by the captain of the L.A. Kings, and then go, hey, maybe I'll try this story about running track by this person I don't know, Jackie Woodson. Mm-hmm.
And I had
find other readers.
I had a similar experience when I was a kid. I used to read books like Good Field, No Hit, baseball books.
Yeah.
And then when I was allowed into the adult section of the Brooklyn Public Library, I found a book that had a baseball player on the cover. It was called The Natural by Bernard Malamud.
Oh, nice.
And I took it out because it was a baseball book. And that's when I started discovering other kinds of writers, adult writers for myself. When I look back at that book, I don't know how I got through it with the age of 13 or 14 because it's really serious literature. But it also allowed me to start developing my own taste because my parents had read different kinds of books, good books, Faulkner, etc. But there I was discovering Bernard Malamud that led to Saul Bellow and a whole bunch of James Baldwin, etc., etc. I could develop my own reading list as a result. All just because of baseball books.
That's a fantastic thing to realize, too, that as a reader, we pride ourselves on our taste and our selection. Mm-hmm. So when I talk to teachers and parents who are kind of stressed out about their kids not reading or what they are reading, I say, you got to let them choose, though. You got to let them work through that because, like, they're not going to be proud of some book that got assigned to them. They want to say, here's who I am as a reader. These are the books I like.
I never liked the books that I was assigned in school, and then I would read them over the summer and fall in love with them. But that's because I came to them on my own. Margarita from North Shore, you're on
right.
The air.
Yes. So what you just said about stepping into your discovery of books, sort of towards adulthood, is a fun segue because I fell in love with Charlotte's Web by E.B. White when I was a kid. And he felt like my first independent discovery somehow. I don't remember if most other kids' books were recommended by teachers or parents. But then to grow up and realize that he also wrote for The New Yorker and wrote essays, and because I was both born in Brooklyn and lived in Maine as a kid, I felt as though I had made a lifelong friend through that first discovery, which was really cool.
And now you're in Massachusetts.
And now I'm in Massachusetts. Still with a love of both New York and Maine.
Now, Charlotte's Web is another one of those books that seems to endure. Do you have any sense of why some books do just go on and others have their moment?
It's a really good question that I ask myself often. I think
that's also true with adult literature.
Yeah, but I think...
By Love Possessed, remember it was a giant... A monstrous bestseller. Does anybody read it anymore?
I haven't even read it the first time around.
Yeah.
Think of something like Knucklehead, which has been in my by John Jesko, which has been in our family's rotation for years and years and years. And it's just, it's funny, it's thoughtful. And I think Charlotte's Web, the same thing. There is a way in which these books are timeless, right? Even though we know they take place in a period of time, there's this timelessness that they're not dated or placed in one situation that we can't relate to for years and years and generations.
The last caller was from Massachusetts. A listener from London named Linda wrote to us to recommend Ellie's Adventures, the Ellie's Adventure Picture Story books, which teach children about the importance of taking care of the environment. Can books like that have a lasting impact on a person?
Books
teach? I think that's in that same way, like we were talking about, books that kids are interested in. The strangest books kids can latch onto, too, and that can just become... kind of their mission statement. And I'm sure she was probably a kid who that just struck her, that moment when she read that book, to say, like, yeah, I can do something. Here's someone who's thinking the same thing I am.
Last week, the Washington Post published a list of books curated by a Maryland children's librarian designed to bring, quote, hope and strength in stressful times, as well as to inspire activism. A lot of adults are looking to the literary world for similar inspiration right now, but can you talk about the role of children's literature in these politically chaotic times?
Well, I think adults should be reading it. Maryland librarian's list is not just for young people, it's for adults too. And I think given how stressed out we are, being able to pick up a picture book and gain some hope in 32 pages is a good thing. And also, they tend to resonate. So I think we do need to slow down and escape in the literature that's being offered to us and acknowledge that the stuff that children are reading and children themselves are important to all of our futures.
Let's take another call. Joan from North, what is it, Haledon, New Jersey?
Hello?
Yes, hello. Go ahead, Joan.
Oh, okay. My favorite book, and still is, when I was young, To Kill a Mockingbird. I know that probably sounds a lot different than the ones that people have been mentioning, but...
No, we actually started off by...
was an attorney, and my father was Atticus Finch. He many times was paid in things. Hmm. He worked with people that didn't have much. You know, he didn't do any big lawsuits and money collecting things. That wasn't what he wanted to do. He was a pretty religious guy and very, you know, concerned about people. And, you know, even now when I either watch the movie or reread the book, it's like reading about him. You know, he believed in fairness and equality, you know, all the good things.
And we actually mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird is a favorite of adults. It's a favorite of kids as well. She really hit a nerve there, didn't she?
Yeah, heartily.
What resonates, too, with people is in children's books, we get that. I guess it's kind of a luxury. You can kind of be unafraid to deal with the really tough topics. I mean, I have second graders who ask me things like, why are we here? Which is kind of the ultimate question. And I love that about them. And so something like To Kill a Mockingbird really, like, gets into it.
Jen from Huntington, Long Island, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to ask Ms. Woodson her opinion about, I'm a school librarian, and I really try to have, you know, diversity present throughout the year and not just save it for 1 month. Mm-hmm. But I noticed
the shortest
my
month.
Book...
It's the shortest month, too.
It is. It is. And there's a week-long, yes, there's a week-long holiday event where the kids are off. But when I teach book club, I run a book club after school. I have second and third graders. There seems to be a lack of diversity in chapter books for this age group. There's a lot of picture books and then the older grades, fifth grade and up. But I didn't know if I was missing something as a brand new librarian or if you saw this as well.
No, I don't think you're missing something. I think that is a place where there is a gap in our literature. And, I mean, you know, John's books, The Time Warp Trio, I think there's a person of color in there now, right, John?
Yeah, like and, all the time and everywhere we go.
And the stories Julian tells and more stories Julian tells, the Diamond Danielle series by Nikki Grimes. There are a couple that are out there, but it is a place where they're... Where you can look at picture books and you can look at middle grade, but there, in that space in between, there's work to do. You're absolutely right. And of course, you could go to sites like WeNeedDiverseBooks.org. You can go to the Coretta Scott King site. Well, you know this as a librarian, and you can find some books to fill those gaps. Put a Bell Prey, and so there are a couple of places. And I think also books on tape coming back to audiobooks for that age group, they can read up a little bit. There are enough books that don't go too deeply into waters that parents might not want young people to go into right now, but where the language is so that they can have access to it, even if they're struggling readers or reluctant readers.
Moira on Twitter says her second son wasn't into reading when he was younger, but loved Tintin. She says it was a good segue into reading. Sometimes it just takes the right book for the kid to connect to.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Lynn on Twitter writes, I tried to make Nancy Drew a thing for my friend's girls, but it didn't take. And she wonders if that ever happened to either of you.
I'm not trying to push Nancy Drew on anybody. I'm sorry. I've never had that problem with Nancy Drew. I've definitely gotten into the 21st century with reading. And sometimes, I don't know if you have this, John, but you go back and read a book and it doesn't hold up that way. One of your favorite children's books. But I wouldn't expect Nancy Drew to hold up. No offense.
On the other hand,
I even think like some of that's the wrong approach with a book. It's almost like talking about it like it's some kind of, I don't know, psoriasis treatment or something. Like, it didn't work. But you really have to like find out who that reader is. And Jackie and I both have sons who at one point in their life were, I guess we could call them less than enthusiastic readers.
That's because their parents were writers.
And it's crazy for us. We like, you know, almost want to strangle them and say, come on, this is our business. This is what's feeding you.
It's so true.
Jeffrey from Manhattan called in to say that he loved The Wind in the Willows and that it taught him how to be an adult as well. And happens with a number of these books.
Yeah, I forgot about Wind in the Willows. Those are great old crazy British books.
So what did we finally establish here? That if you can get a kid reading, you engage the kid in the world and get them thinking about not only what's going on in their own lives, but what's going on in other people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a win-win situation.
It does. And I have to tell you, my trick with my kids is I leave books in their bathroom. Accidentally,
nice.
Quote unquote, as opposed to saying you should read this book. I leave it in their bathroom and they're trapped in there for a while. And sure enough, they come out reading the book.
No, and that's a great low key approach, too. I think that's our mission, like, is just to give it a try. Mm-hmm. I kind of hope that with the short stories, like kids read them and go like, I didn't like that one. I go, try the next one or don't try another one.
Yeah, the book is out there, and I love that you're asking people to talk about their favorite books, because I think once we begin having this conversation, more books come up for Anne. Hopefully they're sharing those with the young people in their lives.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, because there are so many more books out there. People are calling in with wonderful books. My great thanks to all of you who called in, and to Jacqueline Woodson, author of Brown Girl Dreaming, Miracles Boys, and more, and John Shishka, author of The Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales, Math Course, Curse, and more. It's been a lot of fun talking about these books.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Leonard.